is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. Appreciate y'all taking time this Sunday to come join us here on Midrats. And as a reminder to those that are with us live, if you haven't already, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. There you can find the chat room. If you have some questions for our guests you don't think that Eagle One and I are going to bring up, or if you just have some observations about the show, that's a great place to be there. Eagle One and the usual suspects and I will be there throughout the show, and we will try to fold in what we can as we go forward. And if you have to leave halfway through the show, or if you want to catch up on some shows you may have missed, you can always go over and get the full archive at Blog Talk Radio. Also, on occasion, we'll be coming near the end of the show, and we'll be in the middle of a real good question, or there's one more we just have to ask. Well, if you're with us live at the one-hour moment, the show will end. However, the tape keeps rolling, and you can go back to the archive, and you can get that last few minutes of the show. And if you're up on the show page, we'll go ahead and tell you how many more minutes we're in there and what exactly we're talking about. Usually some really good nuggets are there, so you can always get it the second time around right there. But, hey, let's get on with the show. As we put out in a lot of the pre-show items, the newest shipbuilding plan for 2014, it hit the streets. A lot of talk about it last week. And if you haven't had a chance to look at some of the details. It's kind of the executive summary PowerPoint for those that like spreadsheets over there linked at my home blog. And if you really have trouble getting to sleep, there's the full 216-page justification of estimates that you can plow into if you'd like. But when you look at it in a larger context, you know, we have to ask ourselves, with what we see in this, is there good news here? Is it more of the same? Or are there some systemic issues behind the numbers that maybe tell a different story than what you may have read last week? And what can the Navy expect using this as a benchmark and knowing what we're looking at? What is the follow-on for sequester? What are the additional budget challenges we're going to have? What can we look at the next few years that may move the needle one way or another for the 2015, 16, 17, 18, and on budgets we'll be seeing before we know it? We have two great returning guests on today to talk about this and more. And again, it's linked over at the show page, but also over my home blog. We're going to use kind of as a touching off point the article that our two guests penned last week over at Real Clear Defense titled, quote, "Shipbuilding Plan Portends a Navy in Decline." And we'll use a reference from there, and then we'll start to wander where we need to go. And our guest will be Mackenzie Eaglin. She's a resident fellow at the Maryland Ware Center for Security Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Brian McGrath, Director, Deltex Consulting Studies and Analysis. Mackenzie and Brian, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Mackenzie, let's go ahead and throw the first question your direction. You know, last week, one thing that popped out immediately in my email and in conversations with people, said, hey, you look at this, we got 43 ships under contract. We haven't seen good news like this since John Lehman was SecNav. This is all good news, heading in the right direction. Is that really the best initial takeaway from this, or are there some things going on in the background that perhaps people need to be a little more aware of?
Well, it's a great question, and I was thinking of the answer. Is it good news? Is it more of the same? Or are there things behind this iceberg underground that we need to talk about? And actually, the answer is it's all three. If we're looking in the very near term, what's in front of our nose, sure, that's good news. And I'm just as pleased about that as Secretary of the Navy, who is taking credit for it. You know, he deserves that, and it's important. That's the minimum they need to be doing right now, and it's good to see progress on getting ships under contract. problem, the reason I'm worried about this, the iceberg to this problem below the surface, is that the department's budget and this shipbuilding plan puts at risk that number. So 43 right now is a very loose number. And when we're talking about a department staring down sequestration year two, because the sequester is currently coming down the pike, it is currently being worked through the system in this budget year, 2013 and calendar year. But there's much more to come, unfortunately, in 2014, even if it's undone. And so that's not a number that I can say hard and fast is going to hold up, which scares me. Beyond that, though, you know, I know Brian will talk to this a little bit. It's also bad news. It's also more of the same. I mean, at the end of the day, we've thrown out for good the 313 shipbuilding plan a couple of years ago. That went out the window. We're now at about a 298 or 300 ship Navy as the newly revised downward fleet size. And, of course, we never get there in this president's term or even the next guy's first term. These are always things really far in the out years. It's important, but it's a long-term plan. And when you start shaving off 15 ships of your long-term plan, that's a worrisome trend. And at the end of the day, while the news right in front of our nose is good, the bad news is that the Navy is still retiring more ships than it's building, and it's still shrinking over the next 5 years. And that's really the number that matters, because it's a pattern, and it speaks to how much money is available now. And we know that's not a good news story going forward. There's going to be even less next year.
One of the questions I had was whether this is an example of strategy by budget instead of budget. Let me make sure I've got this right. Are we creating a strategy because of our budget, and that's why we're going to have the number of ships we have, or is that the reverse of the way we should do it, which is, in my view, you have a strategy and then you devise a budget to meet that strategy?
You know, I think the department, and again, Brian will jump in here, but I think the department would tell you they're going to put the best face on it and say this was a little bit of both. At the end of the day, the simple reality is that the Pentagon and the entire federal government was handed the Budget Control Act, the debt ceiling deal, and everything came after that, including this new, you know, the new 300-ship plan, out with the 313, the new sequester budgets, and the January guidance from last year and the pivot to Asia. All of that is purely reactive to the budget targets that have been handed down. What worries me more is not that the strategy is being driven by the budget, because that is a problem, but it's a perennial problem for the department. You know, we haven't really had a sound defense strategy since the end of the Cold War, so it's not exclusive to this administration. What worries me more is that the Joint Chiefs are telling Congress and Washington that the pivot to Asia strategy of last January is on a razor-thin edge of credibility, and you tinker with it at any point and with any dollar amount, you know, $1, $5, $10 billion, $50 billion, and the whole thing goes out the window, and it's irrelevant, and it's unexecutable, and it's high risk, et cetera. Well, that wasn't a very sound strategy then, if it couldn't hold up to Congress tweaking the budget, which by law is how it works and what they're supposed to do. And certainly, if it can't manage changes of the nature we're talking about under sequester.
Brian.
There's a couple things I'd like to chime in on here, and this is something we mentioned in our article. This 43 ships under contract is a fiction. The LCS deal of a couple of years ago was not a multi-year procurement. It was an agreement. It was a pricing agreement. It said we will buy 10 of these ships and 10 of these ships for this price. And that is the price you will give us if we exercise the option to acquire them. Unlike the multi-year procurement for DDGs and the multi-year procurement for SSNs, in which we really are obligating the federal government with considerable penalties to buy a certain number of ships over a certain period of years. So, you know, technically the ships are under contract, but they're not under – you know, all contracts are not the same. So there are roughly, I think it's 18 or 20 of those 43 that are simply pricing agreements. That's one thing to think about. The second thing that I would like to think about is I'd like to reinforce what Mackenzie said. Most strategies are budget driven. Bob Work used to say, strategy without resources is dreaming out loud. This was a particularly easy to accuse of being budget driven because of the proximity of the strategy to the Budget Control Act and the first $497 billion hit. So, you know, when the chiefs got together and their subalterns got together and began to craft what became the Defense Strategic Guidance of January 2012, they had already, you know, taken a half a trillion dollar bogey, and so, you know, we really are in a budget driven strategic environment. But as Mackenzie said, that's not that bad. It's kind of the way it always is. But the problem is that this, as she said, the strategy that they came up with or the strategic narrative that they came up with, I think is a sound one. It's one that I was very excited about when I saw it, and I looked, and I keep writing about how I wish to see some evidence that it's actually being implemented, and it's not. I mean, if you look at the Navy's charts for the numbers of ships that will be in the Asia-Pacific region in 2020, it's approximately, I think, 9 ships more than are there now. But none of those ships are cruisers, destroyers, or SSNs. They are LCSs. They are a couple of amphibs. They are some JHSVs. Combat power is not moving to Asia. And that's something that troubles me, because I think that's what we need there.
I don't want to pile on to our host, but I will just add one other point. It's really, you know, in DOD's, to knock them a little bit, it's not a strategy. At the end of the day, there are 8 or 12 page documents that came out last January. It is accurately called strategic guidance, but in no way should we actually credibly give them what they think they deserve, which is the credit of it being a strategy. You know, sign me up to the my fellow think tank, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, who put out a great paper basically saying, you know, the whole end, ways and means, right? This is simply the end, but there is no description of how the department should get there, which is part of the reason I think we're seeing all of the subsequent rationale and the budgets all kind of not holding up under any sort of scrutiny, is because they really are lacking all the meat on the bone.
Just kind of building off of that, you know, Brian, and go ahead and point this your direction. It is, you know, when you sit in the classroom up at the blackboard or the ink board, as we do nowadays, you know, you have your strategy, you know, you need to do that, so you have to build, train, and equip to a certain capability. But if you're inside of a budget and politically driven thing, you have it really cart before horse, where eventually you will have a fleet built that can have a certain capability to it, and you decide, okay, what type of strategy can I do with this, or maybe I'll just make it up as I go along. And when you look at just the numbers, there's more to it than just numbers. You know, 41 in, 42 out, and those numbers will change as years go forward. But when you look at what is being decommissioned and what is being built into the fleet, are there some things going on in the background on fleet composition that is creating a different type of fleet with different capability sets, even though they are more modern, than what we traditionally have been looking at in the last 15, 20 years?
Yeah, we are. We're creating a smaller, less capable Navy by trading out cruisers, getting rid of cruisers early, cruisers that come with, you know, an 8-pack of harpoons to shoot other ships with, and instead we're creating, you know, we're building LCSs, JHSVs, and MLPs as their replacements. The DDGs that we've built ever since number 79, which I think was right around 1999, from no DDG has had a surface-to-surface missile except the Standard missile, which is basically horizon limited. since 1999. We are becoming less and less capable of sea control. And sea control is the necessary predicate for everything else. You cannot project power unless you control the seas, period, end of story. I believe we have an insufficient number of SSNs, and the pressure is going to be downward on our SSNs. So, yeah, when I look at these numbers, I see some interesting things. I do like some of the sea-basing ideas. I do like the continuing to at least shoot at 33 amphibs. I'd like to see 38. But in the main, the combat punch of the surface fleet is declining, and I don't see any real plan to turn that around, until we get some sort of an anti-surface weapon into the fleet, and that'll be 10 years from now.
And Mackenzie, let's roll this over to you, and if you could please kind of take one of the things Brian brought up. The move away from sea control, and what is your take on that? Was that a trade-off? Is it complacency, or is it just short-sightedness?
I see this across the services and across the domains. It's certainly not exclusive to sea power. It's also very much resident in air and space power, for example, where the core competencies of the U.S. military and our long standing traditional margins of military technological superiority, they're declining across the board and across the domains, across the services. This is incredibly worrisome. I don't think a lot of these decisions are happening outright. Perhaps in some cases in the Air Force it is, but for the Navy, I think the worst outcome and exactly what is happening is that our political class is backing into these decisions. So there isn't this lively and public discussion about what we're trading off and what we're giving up, things that everybody has come to expect under any circumstance. The American people expect it, and Congress expects it, and the Commander-in-Chief expects those options available to him. And there is no discussion of the consequences of these trade-offs and what changes? What will we not do? How much longer will it take? What are the casualty increases and the timeline extensions? All of the things that are inherent in these decisions of giving up core competencies, the building blocks of our military capabilities. And they're going away slowly but surely, and they're eroding over time, which makes them so much more difficult to get back. I'd much rather have the public debate where we all say, yes, throw this out. No, keep that and bolster it. But the way we're doing it, this slow degradation and rusting of capabilities, makes it twice as expensive and longer to build when you decide that you need to reverse that trend. And everybody says, well, how did this happen? And it's just really, truly the worst case.
Yeah, I'm for those of people who missed it, the Navy announced that it's going to continue to retire 7 cruisers in 2015, but they also announced that they're going to retire a couple of logistics ships. A couple of oilers are going to go, and as an old logistics-minded kind of guy, that really troubles me. When we're going to cut a logistics force, which is already stretched pretty thin, I question. I mean, we've already discussed the fact that I'm not sure we have a strategy, and if we do have a strategy, we don't seem to be supporting it very well. But doesn't it make you nervous? I mean, I agree with you. Is this just like random decisions, or is there a plan? Do we have a 5-year plan, a 7-year plan, where we want to be in 10 or 15, 20 years with our fleet? Or is this good luck?
What's interesting to me is that the number of ships to be decommissioned in 2015, which I think is 20 ships, has the 7 ships that you mentioned, or it's actually 9 ships, 7 cruisers and 2 amphibs. That $2.4 billion was put into the budget in 2013 to keep online, but it was only 2-year money. And so the Navy said, all right, well, they gave us the money to keep them around for 2 years. We'll keep them for 2 years, and we're gonna get rid of them in 2015. So I'm not going to say that that's passive-aggressive behavior, but it was interesting to be able to follow those ships, and the Navy's quite upfront about it in the shipbuilding plan, that there's no money to keep them around in the budget past 15, so we got to get rid of them. But these are ships that have useful service lives left in them, and I'm struck by the irony of retiring cruisers at the 22 and 23 year point, even as we talk in the shipbuilding plan about the necessity of stretching the Flight II Alpha DDGs to 40 years. It's a shell game. It really is a shell game. The Navy, as an institution, will always retire ships early if it means they can build new stuff. But while those Flight II DDGs, II Alpha DDGs, are young, you can pump your numbers up, and you can have out years from 2030 to 2040 that look rosy. I mean, the 306 ship Navy that was put in the March 2013 force structure assessment that the Navy sent to the Hill. That 306 ship Navy, according to this plan, doesn't get reached until 2037. I understand that the defense strategic guidance and the budgetary and pressures caused the Navy to reprogram, and knowing the guys that do this for a living, I'm sure they did the very best that they possibly could. The problem is not that they're not doing the best they possibly could. It's that they're getting stuck with a bad hand from the start. And you know, Mackenzie and I and others like us, we write, we think, we talk, we scream. We have to start to spend more money on our Navy in order to get what we need from it.
Mackenzie, just kind of building off of that, I want to take out the Eeyore economist part of my brain here for you. About half a decade ago, one of my little mantras I've been saying is we're 5 to 10 years behind Europe. Look at Europe. We're 5 to 10 years behind it from budgetary stress. And Eeyore became a little more predominant, at least in my mind. The last election, I think, just ensures that. And with a lot of my colleagues specifically that I know in the Royal Navy and to a lesser extent in the Dutch and the French navies, they really have had some very shocking changes in the last few years. It occasionally you read about this side of the pond, but not too often. And there's also been a lot of talk about what I like to call the terrible 20s, where in the CNO, thank you, Lee, for the intel report, the CNO was at the Mayport Navy League a couple of days ago, and he reinforced what he had said before, that his number one priority looking forward is recapitalization of the SSBN force. I know there's some wishful thinking about using purple money, but it's really not purple, and you could spend hours talking about that. But when you look at 2020s and specifically the submarines, and if we're really looking at going to the Western Pacific and things we would like to potentially do there, submarines play a lot into that. But just looking at the attack submarines, during the 2020s, we're expected to retire 29, almost 30 just in the 20s themselves, while we're scheduled to only procure 19. I had delivered 19. And that's looking at it from 2013, 2012 mindset. I think good people can argue the other side of the equation. I think the 51% of the smart money is saying we haven't begun to see budget challenges. Submarines are expensive. They take a long time to build. SSBN recapitalization, is 12 really what we are going to be able to do? 10, is that more realistic? Are we really looking at being somewhere closer to 8, which is what I think we're going to wind up being, just because of the budgetary realities that are going to become worse and worse as this decade builds up to the 2020s?
I share all of those fears. I mean, we're talking about an exquisite fleet. It's going to be the B-2 equivalent for the Navy, which is not a good program in place to be. Congress hates those programs because the per-unit cost, you know, triples relative to what you can buy if you have a stable shipbuilding plan, particularly for this highly skilled industrial base that is always at risk. Thankfully, not this year or any time in the next couple of years, but I share those concerns. You know, there's a reason we, you know, those people in Washington, for all of our faults, living in this bubble, We do know that money in the out years, it's monopoly money. And we also know, you know, so it's hard to take anything serious that, you know, beyond a couple of years from now. So when the president submits his budget this year for just the military and says, we're going to fix sequestration for the Defense Department and it's in the next president's term, we can all just roll our eyes and throw it in the trash can because it's just not relevant. It's not important. It just doesn't matter to reality. The same thing goes with these long-term budget plans. They serve a useful purpose for planners. That's what the military does. But what we also know historically, looking back over the last 60 years of defense budget, we know that the Pentagon's five-year budget plan, of which, you know, that's more relevant than anything else we can give the department. You know, the 20-year strategies tend to be less relevant than the five-year budgets. But even those are lagging indicators to reality, to budget reality. And I think you reflected that exactly in your question. You talk to anyone in uniform today, and they'll say exactly how, when, and where, and how often they're feeling the squeeze. We're not even in full sequestration yet, okay? This is a military absorbing tranche one of the Budget Control Act that is not sequester and that is not going to be rolled back under any scenario, barring, I mean, something completely unforeseen, you know, World War kind of scale. So that's what's happening now. That's what sailors and airmen and soldiers feel today and Marines. Okay, so you're right. Now when the squeeze really gets turned on, we already know we can't, unfortunately, as much as I would like the Navy's budget to grow in 2014 as it's planned to do right now, we know that that's the high point. That is the, it's not going to come in like that. Even President Reagan, when his defense budget, his budgets were declining, the military buildup president, he was slow to catch up to the reality. All of his out-year budgets in that time predicted growth in years when growth was not coming. That is every president of every political party. So what do we know? We know politics don't change much. And so, unfortunately, you're right. We are looking at a fleet, and I would agree with you, a single-digit fleet of these if we can get there. You know, when I work backwards and see where we are on particularly the SSBN replacement and the Air Force's new bomber program, because these two programs reflect each other and the debate and the problems that the department as a whole is facing, the Department of Defense, that is. So the two programs track in parallel, and I think, you know, they can both succeed or fall together, frankly. In terms of where we are budgetarily in design and long lead planning and everything else that goes into a program at this phase, if you really want to field it in 2020 or earlier when, you know, that's only 6.5 budget years away, it ain't that long. We're not even close to getting a hole in the water in 6.5 years, and we're nowhere near that. And so already I'm worried that the plan is unstable in terms of the SSBN replacement. And I'm also worried because what we know, regardless of politics, we know that this president is very interested in unilateral strategic forces reductions. And one of the easiest places to go before the end of the second term could easily be the triad. It's just a fact. We all need to talk about it now and what happens and who's going to lose and what is it going to mean for that service. There's no money in eliminating ICBM, so it's either coming down to the Air Force or the Navy, and that means the bomber or the SSBNX goes. And those are the facts as they are right now. We're just not talking about them.
Kenzie, I know you're planning to leave us here in a few minutes. I want to thank you for coming on today and for your comments. I have kind of a question for both of you one of the complaints that a lot of people in Congress have, especially on one party side of the House, is that we don't have any peer competitors. The American military keeps trying to create peer competitors, but we don't have anybody. And everybody says, well, we spend, you know, eight times. We're more powerful than – we're 57 times fat and bigger than the other next biggest military in terms of budget and all that stuff. Is that an accurate metric to use, and is that one of the problems that drives the fleet size here?
I'll jump in. Thanks, Brian, since I have to run. Yeah. It is a problem. It's a problem ever since – well, one, we did lose our peer competitor in the former Soviet Union, but it's also a problem when the department moved away from threat-based planning, because then discussion of these threats became so political, which is quite unfortunate, you know, so that we can't talk about a theory of victory in the Pacific, because people are uncomfortable making, you know, putting where it implies China, for example, or Iran, or you know, anti-access kinds of scenarios. So the capabilities-based planning that really was underway in earnest under Secretary Rumsfeld has set us back, because what the department probably needs is a combination of some threat and capabilities-based planning, where we can have honest discussions and open war plans, you know, relatively open, meaning terms of politicians know what they're signing up for and what they're not. You know, so when that strategic guidance came out last January, you know, senior Navy officials were quick to point out how the war plans were changing, and they are significant and dramatic in terms of downsizing. We are not capable of doing things in a few short years here, of things that we've been able to do for decades. And so, you know, we're asking more of our allies who may or may not have knowingly signed up to these changes. It's a stark shift towards this offshore balancing or this lighter footprint kind of approach, and it does have major implications, and that's exactly where these shipbuilding numbers flow from. I mean, they don't come out of the thin air. They come because the war plans are being shrunk significantly. And so this is happening, and it's incredibly worrisome. It goes back to all of the things we've been talking about, too, because it's not necessarily up front. There's no full and public accounting of risk to those making these decisions about what that exactly that means.
McKinney, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and cut you loose. Really appreciate you taking time to join us this Sunday. Look forward to next time.
Well, I'm only sorry I couldn't stay the full hour, so let's do it again sooner. And thanks again for having me. You guys are the best.
Yes, ma'am. Really appreciate it.
Good. Hey, take care.
You too. Hey, Brian, I want to throw the furry ball back at you here. McKinsey used the S word, sequestration. And I want to pull the thread on that, and here's why. One of the things that's kind of bothered me, I was a kid during the 1970s. You talk about budget problems post-Vietnam. We had it. But you know what? In the 1970s, as a kid, I went to almost every Blue Angels show around. In spite of all that, the Blue Angels are still going. And sequestration, which really, when you use your upper brain functions, it's serious. It has some very big implications for the military, more than a lot of places. But when the Navy canceled the Blue Angels show, it seemed to me to be a cheap gimmick like you would expect from other cabinet departments. And the fact that you and I both know that there are other things out there that you probably could have skimmed that additional flight hour time and TAD travel time from, as opposed to something like taking away the Blue Angels. I love the example we saw this week. Yeah, we're taking away the American public and our best recruiting tool, the Blue Angels, but hey, we're still paying $57 a gallon for synthetic fuel. Did we really, and have we really seriously tried to put out what sequestration really means to the American public and what their Navy and their military can do? And what was the purpose behind doing what I still say is a cheap gimmick, i.e. we're pulling back on the Blue Angels? And who was the 100-pound head that decided that was the best thing to do?
Well, the thing about sequestration, and I think the CNO and others have been pretty upfront about this, the cuts, the magnitude of the cuts is bad. But if you handed him a bill and said, cut 9.6%, he could do it, and he could do it relatively easily. But that's not what sequestration does. It takes a horizontal slice out of virtually every account. There are several accounts that are off limits by agreement between the president and the Congress when they put the Budget Control Act of 2011 together. But at the end of the day, what is insidious about sequestration is that it takes a cut from every single program, irrespective of how important it is to you. And the Secretary of the Navy and the CNO have almost no latitude in how those cuts are made. So your most important programs are getting cut 9.6%, and fluff is getting cut 9.6%, or whatever the number is. I think it's 9.6. I honestly don't know what the impact on the Blue Angels is, whether they're canceling the whole season or just certain shows. I don't know how finely tuned the gears of their maintenance and their operations are with respect to the money that they use. I'm not ready to say that it's a cheap trick, but it seems to me to be probably worth revisiting. And I think the CNO should probably take a look at maybe even requesting some special execution year reprogramming to get them back in the air.
You were talking earlier about the loss of sea control that we could be facing. To a certain extent, that would be driven, it seems to me, by the fact that the LCS is a marginal replacement for anything useful. But am I wrong there? I mean, is there some magic that's going to make the LCS the frigate or whatever it is that we don't have because we have the LCS?
You know, as I look out at a potential fight with China, and I'm not one of those people who dances around this subject, so I take it. I don't see it happening anytime soon. I see it happening if it happens in 10 or 15 or 20 years, as they get more powerful, as they go further in their desire to create their own sphere of influence in the Western Pacific. If we ever fight the Chinese, we are going to have to fight just to get forward. We're going to have to fight to stay forward. Open ocean convoy escort ASW is not dead. And the LCS variants can do many things. I have not been one of the great LCS critics. I'm certainly not an LCS supporter. I see it has a niche and it has a role and it can do some interesting things. But open ocean ASW is not one of them, and the P-8 is not going to be able to do that. And we're getting rid of – every time we put a cruiser away, we put away a 19 tail. I find myself thinking that these are short-sighted decisions. Sea control is ASW. Sea control is ASUW. Those who try to tell me when I get on my hobby horse about surface-to-surface missiles, you know, they say, well, that the air wing will take care of that. That's just garbage. The air wing is not going to take care of that. The air wing isn't going to be in a position to help. They're going to be doing other things. And, oh, by the way, the air wing doesn't practice ASUW all that much. We have made some strides in arming our helicopters, our organic helicopters, to do some sort of ASUW work against some small patrol vessels and the like. But I'm talking about big, heavy, harpoon-like missiles that can help, can at least do a mission kill on a ship. We're not there. And the fleet we're building appears to me to the surface ship we're building appears to me to have some capability gaps in ASUW and ASW. And by the way, every time we put a cruiser away, we lose a very capable integrated air and missile defense ship. Yes, we continue to build integrated air and missile defense ships, but I think there's clearly a demand for them, and that demand doesn't seem to be going away.
I want to keep pulling the thread on a couple things you brought up there. When you look back, you know, the old phrase, anytime you go to war, every plan doesn't survive first contact with the enemy. But when you look at recent experience, it gives you a template to build off of. For instance, at the end of World War I, submarines and surface raiders were a big deal. When World War II kicked off, they tried surface raiders and submarines. Surface raider didn't work out, but the submarine did pretty darn good. And we had to relearn ASW all over again. And when you look at, in order to create the effects you would want to in Western PAC, you would have to fight your way through the second and the first chain. How, we don't know. But when you look at what have punched holes in the bottom of ships in the conflicts of the last few decades, it's been submarines and it's been mines, ASW and MIW. And right now, our big plan for that, on the surface ship side at least, is a part-time solution with experimental technology on the littoral combat ship. Let's take an assumption and say that that does not quite work the way we wanted to. What is our plan B to do ASW and do MIW if in 10 years that's just not fitting the bill? And especially if you're in a situation where the Japanese, for whatever reason, Westpac, decide not to come out to play. Do we have a plan B? And if we do have a plan B, is it ready to go?
I don't have a good answer for you on MIW. I believe that the move toward towards doing mine warfare from outside of the minefield is a good move. I believe that the direction that the MIW modules are taking, to the extent that I understand them, is a solid, defensible idea. I will tell you, in all honesty, at least half of the LCSs we build should be MIW.
Are you talking about dedicated MIW, i.e. bolt them and leave them there, vice mission module?
I'm talking about bolt them and leave them there. I am not convinced ultimately that we are going to ever really exercise this swap out of mission modules capability. It's just going to be another O&M cost that will be low hanging fruit.
Exactly.
I think we ought to just go ahead and build 24 minesweep LCSs, and perhaps even alter the propulsion plant, because you don't need a 40 some odd knot minesweep. But at the end of the day, the technology that I am aware of that LCS will field in the next 10 years in the MIW module, it makes sense to me. And so you ask what plan B is, and I find myself thinking, well, we don't do plan B, right? We're the U.S. Navy. We have plan A, and we struggle and bleed and figure it out. CG-47, the first Aegis cruiser, the first spy radar, had a ton of problems, But we worked it out. Spy-1B on Princeton, CG-59. A ton of problems. We worked it out. We'll work out the problems with LCS. We'll work out the problems with the mine warfare module. I just don't think we're going to have enough of them, in terms enough dedicated mine warfare platforms, and that's something I'd like to see us buy into.
Well, that raises the question, which is, as I look at the budget, it's not a single line item in there for any kind of special mine warfare ships. So I guess the theory is we're going to go with these unmanned units and stuff. And that also, the kind of budget, at least the table that I'm looking at, it doesn't really get into how we're going to address the unmanned world of anti-submarine and anti-mine and anti-surface vessels. Is there a path that you could foresee where this budgeting process would start adding things like that in as line items, where we would have a better idea of what the logic is, the feel for where they're going with this stuff?
That's a great question, and the shipbuilding plan makes reference to. You can see there's a couple places in here where they're laying the predicate for an argument that is a good argument. It's an argument worth having, that the present way that we count and that we look at the fleet may not be the most effective representation of combat power. For instance, my calculations lead me to believe we could build 50 large diameter UUVs for every Virginia class submarine. Is that something we would want to do? We might. We very well might want to do that someday, because these LD UUVs, the potential, the things that we can do, or the concepts of operation, be it launching UAVs from UUVs, long-term trail of enemy submarines. There's all kinds of amazing stuff out there that we can do with these things. So if we take it, like if we cannibalize or we eat the money that would have gone to an SSN, guys like me who watch these things like Hawks, we go, oh my goodness, that's terrible. We're going to go ahead and we're going to eat it. You know, we're not going to build that submarine. But if we built 50 LD UUVs for that, hey, that may be a good idea. And so I think ultimately we're going to have to figure out how to get better in terms of gauging fleet strength as a function of something other than hull numbers. Now, I realize it sounds ironic for me, a guy who counts hulls and complains about it, but my point has always been you have to start with the hull count. That is, you know, that's at least where you start. You can have a more nuanced way of describing combat power by adding other things in, but you've got to start with ship count, and that's where Bob Work and I have argued in the past.
Over in the chat room, Brian, a couple guys were bringing up earlier on in the hour, you know, a lot of these, I refuse to put a T in front of them, the AOs, the AOEs. That, you know, put those in the reserve because, you know, if the balloon goes up, goodness knows we're going to need them. And it reminded me that, you know, for the last 100 years, from the end of World War I up through the end of the Cold War, when there was a requirement to build up naval forces, whether in the late 30s, early 40s, it was the four-stack destroyers, up through Ronald Reagan's recommissioning of the battleships, we had a reserve fleet in a USNR that was there that you could pull into. I think the build-up after the Korean War started is just an incredible example of that, really kind of unique in time because of the excess left over from the Second World War. But if in the next 10 or 15 years what you say, you know, potentially could take place, a war with China, you know, we'll figure it out when we get there, the one big difference is there's no there. If the there is a reserve fleet, if the there is an active USNR that could really flesh out and rebuild a fleet more often than has been our history in the last century, the war truly will be come as you are. Because of the unless we had lead time, kind of like we did before World War II, where we were able to at least get the industrial base building up some momentum. You know, that being said, and the reality of naval warfare is when 14 ships sortie, expect a lot of them not to come back. You know, the British reinforced that in the Falklands. Part of the reason for a fleet to fight is ships are going to be sunk so you can win. How do we build that into a sustainable plan that we can actually look at, you know, beyond 1 year? And is there an appreciation of the fact that things are much different than they've been in the last century if a medium and upsized conflict comes forward where ships and fleets will go forward and will come back smaller every time they do?
Yeah, I mean, attrition, combat attrition in modern naval warfare is something that no industrial power that I know of, even the Chinese, can afford to factor in. We simply, I mean, again, this may sound ironic coming from a conservative Republican, but we can't afford to build, to retain ships, a significant number of ships or a useful number of ships in the reserve force. As far as I'm concerned, the naval reserves ought to be stuff that the active duty force doesn't do, and doctors and nurses. This suggestion that we would have some element of combat power in the reserves strikes me as antithetical to what navies do. The modern U.S. Navy is forward deployed in a powerful fashion, and it is forward deployed in that powerful fashion to look after the interests of the United States of America, to deter adversaries, and to assure friends. The reserve, to the extent that there's a reserve to that combat power, it's the guys who are on their way home, the guys who are working up, and the guys who are in the yards. And I think that's a reality. If you gave me more money, I would put it into building ships that go into the active duty Navy. I wouldn't spend a dime on putting additional combat power into some kind of a reserve force. Now, if you want to speak specifically to the combat logistics force, that is a huge soft underbelly right now. We do inadequate attrition planning for those ships, and those are going to be some of the first ships they go after. So I think I saw two TAOs removed from this shipbuilding plan, and that was one of the things that I found most troubling.
Yeah, speaking as a retired reserve officer, let me say you're absolutely right. I mean, the reserves are not capable of supporting the kind, you know, logistic ships in that kind of operation, especially if those things are actually needed. You can train various bodies to do lots of things that the active force doesn't do. That's perfect. Then reserves can be called forward as needed. But the combat force, combat power in the reserves is just in my experience, just a waste of money and time. But let me ask another question. We've got one of our readers or listeners sent me an email with some questions, and mostly they relate to the way we budget our funding. Is this goofy budget where we do all these out-year, five-year plans, all that stuff, is it just a shell game? Is there a better way for us to actually present what we're really trying to do in terms of a fleet? I mean, does that go along with the need to have a real strategy, or is this one of these cases where we've always done it this way and that we're stuck with it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, let's face it; it seems to work, right? You know, as bad as everything is, as bad as things have been, we still have the most powerful Navy the Earth has ever seen. We do it in a political environment in which the American public doesn't have a clue what we do. They really don't. The sense that every year the Pew does their polls and they test the American public on how important the respective armed services are. The Navy's either always third or fourth. They brief this to the admirals at the flag officer conferences, and all the admirals beat their breasts and put their hair shirts on, get all upset. And I always think to myself, why does it matter? We get what we need because the decision makers understand the value of sea power to the American Republic. Is a five-year plan fictitious? Yes. Yes. Three of those 5 years are 50% confidence or less. Two of them are pretty good. And what it does is it gives the industrial base some idea of the direction you're headed. And I think that is important. And I think it serves that purpose. I mean, right now, if I am the CEO of Huntington Ingalls, I am wondering what my revenue stream is going to be in the next 15 years, because I look at the Navy's shipbuilding plan. I look at the historical funding of shipbuilding, and ain't no way we're going to build 43 ships. Ain't no way we're going to have a 306-ship Navy unless there is a significant increase in dollars added to the historical levels of investment in shipbuilding. Let's face it, the SSBN sucks all the oxygen out of the room starting in 2019 or 2021, I think it's 21. $6 billion a year for, you know, $6 billion a hull. That's a lot of money. And, you know, I think the industrial base has to start to plan, and they will plan, and they will shrink, and they will expand as necessary.
Brian, I like the quote y'all ended the article with, we referenced earlier on in the show over at Real Clear Defense. Quote, "A Navy in decline in peacetime is less ready to fight and is potentially more likely to be required to," unquote. Just like the cliche goes, where, you know, enemy gets a vote, well, other nations get to build their fleets as well. And specifically looking at the Chinese fleet as it continues to grow in size, peering into your crystal ball, so to speak, eventually our curve and their curve are going to intersect, or at least reach a point, you know, of being in close proximity, that there is a change in dynamic on our abilities versus their abilities. And how do you see that manifesting itself, either in the behavior of the Chinese or perhaps focusing our attention a little more on what we should be doing?
Yeah. The Chinese Navy is getting marginally larger, but is getting qualitatively much, much better. That is something that we should be – that interests me and something I track rather closely. They got a ton of submarines. They're going to start getting rid of some of these crappy old diesels, and they're putting some reasonable diesels and some reasonable nukes out into the playing field. But in terms of just plain ship numbers, I'm more impressed with the quality that is coming out than I am the size. So then I look and I think, okay, what is it they want to do? The Chinese Navy is not interested, and the Chinese government is not interested in having a Navy that does what our Navy does. They don't want to be the guarantors of the global system. They want to be able to police their part of the world. They want to exercise the same level of hegemony in that part of the world that we exercise in the Western Hemisphere. And what keeps them from doing that is us, the U.S. Navy. China doesn't ever have to build a Navy as big or as good as ours. They need to build a Navy that is big enough and good enough to contest ours in that part of the world. That's what I think they're doing.
Yeah, that's a great point, because and I think that cuts back to something we talked about earlier, where somebody was talking about, you know, the U.S. fleet is much larger than the rest of the world, and we spend all this money on defense. Well, yeah, we do, because we're so many more places doing so many more things than anybody else. And if people want us to stop doing that, then that should be a national discussion and a strategy talk, instead of just having the sequestration come in and cut the budget.
If the world didn't work well with a dominant sea power, we wouldn't have had one for the last 400 years. It's the way the world works best. And until some other way of regulating the global system presents itself, I'm going to stay with the dominant sea power. And the Chinese don't seem interested in that. And I believe we gain handsomely, if not disproportionately, from our position of leadership. We make the rules in that global system. And we enforce those rules with our dominant sea power. That's something we cannot lose, because we will not be the power that regulates the system if we do not have the dominant sea power to perform that task.
You know, Brian, that point you brought up is something that I wish somebody smarter than me could really put together to explain to policymakers and to the American people. That point that you brought out, exactly right. There are so many positive things we get by being the dominant naval force that, you know, you don't directly see the benefit, but you don't have to scratch too deep to see the second and third level positive benefit to our nation economically, diplomatically, culturally, everything else. So there is a lot more there than just numbers and the ability to find a near peer, et cetera, and so forth. And I really appreciate you taking time today to come on and join us here to talk about this real important subject, because there was stuff all over the place last week after the 2014, and I really appreciate you and also Mackenzie coming on to help our listeners and Eagle One and myself think about it a little deeper.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for doing this. I can talk about this stuff all day, and that you guys give me a platform every now and then to do it is much appreciated.
Well, no, really good.
Glad to have you here, and thank you very much for coming. We'll have you back again soon.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. And thank you, everybody, for joining us here, either live or on the archive. Next week will be a best of, but then join us again for another edition of MidRats. Have a great Navy Day.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me.